Hello everyone, welcome to this next episode of the PwC Tax Byte podcast series. My name is Pieter De Rey, a global tax director in Brussels, and I'm with me today. I have two experienced people, Tom Patten and Evi Geerts, who will talk about the developments around the global minimum taxation. Tom, well known from previous podcasts, but Tom is an international tax partner on secondment in the UK and working with various multinationals. And Evi Geerts is an experienced international tax director here in our team in Brussels, focusing a little bit more perhaps on the European side, where Tom, of course, will be able to bring the US side in this podcast. We will talk about the introduction of a global minimum taxation. Not a new topic. We talked about this in previous podcasts before. We had a podcast specifically on the US reform, on the Pillar 1, Pillar 2, and on the proposal for a business taxation for the 21st century. So we will build on that in this podcast, and perhaps as an intro, my first question, Evi, is for you. Can you recap a little bit what happened in the past days?
Absolutely, Pieter. So last Thursday, the OECD Inclusive Framework announced agreement with most of its members on a couple of items related to Pillar 1, but we're not going to focus on that now, but also to Pillar 2. So the following items are either confirmed or clarified in that announcement and are worthwhile noting. The first one is the confirmation of the minimum effective tax rate of the income inclusion or the undertaxed payment rule, and that is 15%. No surprises there, because that is in line with the G7 agreement of a couple of weeks ago. Then it was also confirmed that international shipping income, as defined under the OECD Model Tax Convention, will be out. So companies that were doubtful in that industry and were doubtful of whether they would be in or out, they now have a definition to look at to assess whether Pillar 2 would be applicable to them. Another interesting one, and one that is helpful for us, is that the percentage for the formulaic substance-based carve-out was shared for the first time. So it will be at least 5% or 7.5 during the first 5 years, which is then a transition period. And that is 5 or 7.5% of the carrying value of tangible assets and payroll. So when with this new news, we can now do a more detailed calculation. So we know minimum rate 15% and we know the percentage for the carve out. So we can really go a bit deeper into calculating what the impact would be for the group. So I think that's also good news. Then finally, the subject to tax rule, the percentage was released there. Between 7.5% and 9%. Although the 7.5% was already something we saw in some examples, it's the first time that it's really confirmed that the subject to tax rule, which would be a top-up based on income flows between different entities of the group, becomes clear now, and that also allows us to do a bit of an impact assessment where it might have been a bit more difficult before. Then again, confirmation of the timeline, which is still quite ambitious. So entry into force in 2023, and that means that we need to have legislation by 2022. That's a little bit a roundup of the most important items. There were many other references in there, but I think those are the key takeaways from our perspective. Maybe one side note, Pieter, is if we look at it from an European perspective, it's interesting to see that Ireland, Estonia and Hungary, part of the inclusive framework, have not signed on to this announcement and agreement. So when it comes to translating this into a European directive, there are still a couple of members that need to be convinced. So it will be interesting to see how this evolves at the European level. But Tom, if we now look at the US, because obviously this is likely what the EU will be following, 15%, we all know that this is something that came from talks with the US, or if we can even call it a little bit pressure from the US. But 15% is not what is mentioned in the Biden proposals and the Green Book for global minimum taxation in the US. So can you maybe explain a little bit global minimum taxation in the US? What is it and what do we need to take into account, and what changes will we see?
Thanks, Evie. I think it's important to think about or to look at why is the U.S. back at the table, and there are a couple of key areas that the U.S. government is trying to achieve by restarting the, if you will, the dialogue with the OECD. One would be to turn off the unilateral approaches to things like digital taxes and to eliminate those unilateral digital taxes. And another is to have GILTI treated as a compliant income inclusion rule for purposes of Pillar 2. What's most concerning to the U.S. government about that is the ability to have it be recognized as such that if there is an intermediate holdco that adopts their own Pillar 2 regime, that is in effect switched off by recognizing GILTI as being treated as a compliant regime. But there was no mention of 15% in the Green Book itself, but maybe we even just start with the existing rule, which is GILTI and which does not actually operate as a minimum tax regime. In fact, Treasury in effect confirmed this when they were writing regulations after the enactment of GILTI in tax reform in 2017. But so the current system is we have a 21% corporate tax rate, and we look at all the income of our foreign subsidiaries, we aggregate that income, and reduce that amount by a routine return on tangible assets. So that combined amount is then treated as a GILTI inclusion in the United States. And a 50% deduction is allowed against that income. So half of the income is brought into the U.S. tax net. And that's without regard to what level of taxation there is. So there is an income inclusion, but then there are associated foreign tax credits that are allowed to offset the U.S. income. So right away, it doesn't operate like other jurisdictions might approach Pillar 2, which is you only have an income inclusion to the extent the income in question is under tax. So we have, in effect, a full inclusion over and above routine return on tangible assets, and then allow the credits. But the credits are only allowed at 80% of the actual foreign taxes paid. So we start with a 21% regime. We get a 50% deduction. It starts to look like a 10.5% minimum tax regime. But in reality, if it's a minimum tax regime at all, it's probably something like 13 and a bit percent, being the amount of foreign tax that you'd have to pay to generate enough foreign tax credits at 80% of that amount to offset a U.S. tax of 10.5. So what we saw in the Green Book was, in effect, a minimum tax proposed of 21%. And getting there via a corporate tax rate of 28% and a GILTI deduction reduced from 50 down to 25%. But again, because of the 80% haircut on foreign tax credits, what that 21% regime might look like is something closer to 26%, because you'd need foreign taxes of 26%. To then generate enough credits to give you actual creditable taxes at around the 21% mark. So it's all there's a whole lot of complexity in terms of using foreign tax credits in the United States, and I think that pressure that you referred to before from the U.S. is because the Biden administration is really aiming at increasing the overall tax burden suffered by U.S. multinationals and by U.S. corporates. And trying to keep the gap between the U.S. system and other jurisdictions as narrow as possible.
Mm-hmm. And maybe an add-on question to that, Tom, because you already referred to it. It's quite important for the U.S. that GILTI is seen as a income inclusion rule that can coexist with the Pillar 2 rules of the OECD proposal. And the announcement of last week referred to the fact that consideration will be given to the conditions under which GILTI can coexist. Are there any other changes or reference to changes that we need to take into account for GILTI to qualify?
Yeah, what the OECD is alluding to is the fact that GILTI operates on an aggregate approach, right? You take all of the income of your subsidiaries. You aggregate them. That's your income inclusion. You take all the taxes associated with your subsidiaries, aggregate those. That's your foreign tax credit, more or less. And what that allows a taxpayer to do is, in effect, blend its taxes on high taxed income and low taxed income to get a net outcome from a GILTI perspective. So the Biden administration in the Green Book has proposed going full country by country, so having separate inclusions for each country. From a U.S. multinationals perspective, that would create a pretty significant administrative burden over and above what is a pretty significant administrative burden. So it remains to be seen whether we'll go entirely that way or we might take some modified approach. But the other thing the OECD is alluding to is QBI, which is the routine return on tangible assets that I mentioned earlier. And the Green Book proposes to eliminate that. And I think that's something we probably more likely or a clearer approach to eliminate, as far as Congress's legislative action later in the year. But something like country by country is, you know, we'll have to wait and see where we get to on that.
Thanks, Tom and Evie, of course, for this comprehensive overview of the latest steps. I guess a lot of the listeners might also be in a situation where they work for European-headquartered groups with activities in the U.S. And for them, it would be interesting to take a look at, I think, the relationship, the interaction between GILTI and the Pillar 2, which will be followed in the OECD. Tom, is there anything you can share about that? Do you see a particular impact there?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are two key things. First is just simply, it will influence where other jurisdictions might get to in their own Pillar 2 regime. Now, to be fair, they might look at GILTI and say, well, we'll take a different approach. But there's still an influencing factor of the U.S. being at the table and trying to make GILTI more OECD compliant that I think is important for kind of everybody to understand because it could influence their own outbound Pillar 2 regime that they might get. The other is, of course, where the U.S. is not the parent of the group but is an intermediate holdco. So let's say you're a Belgian multinational and you have a U.S. subsidiary that has other foreign operations underneath it, whether it's Canada, Mexico, or somewhere else. That's a little bit less clear what the outlook might be. So, if GILTI is treated as an qualifying income inclusion rule for Pillar 2 purposes, that ought to shut off other jurisdictions, Pillar 2 regimes where they are the intermediate holdco. Where the U.S. is, the only thing we've seen so far, as I mentioned in the Green Book, that when you have that fact pattern and the foreign parent has their own Pillar 2 regime, that the taxes paid by that foreign parent under that regime could be taken into account in applying our own GILTI rules or our own approach on Pillar 2. The issue with that is it's not clear how that will actually work and what that really means. Does that mean we'd pick that up as a foreign tax credit? Is that subject to the 80% rule? Is that subject to other things like expense allocation, things that can erode the ability to take credits? It's not clear yet. And obviously, we're early days in the project, in the process in any event, haven't seen any draft legislation. So it'll really be interesting to see how that might develop. It does feel a bit challenging that that's going to work perfectly, when we see Pillar 2 kind of rolled out more widely across the rest of the world.
Thanks, Tom. And the other one that is, I think, worthwhile mentioning and that a lot of our clients are a little bit nervous about is SHIELD. Let me have a quick look. So that is an acronym for Stopping Harmful Inversions and Ending Low Tax Developments.
Well done.
To my understanding, a replacement of the current BEAT rules, but not at all the same. So can you share a little bit its significance and what the mechanics are as far as we know so at this point in time?
Yeah, so BEAT operates as a minimum tax regime in the United States where you calculate a hypothetical tax, on the basis of your taxable income but without regard to certain related party payments. And, you know, if that hypothetical tax exceeds your regular tax, you pay a top up. And that applies equally to U.S. and non-U.S. multinationals in relation to their U.S. activities. And it applies when your gross receipts in the United States are in excess of $500 million, so, amongst other conditions. That's a point I want to come back to when we look at SHIELD. So SHIELD is effectively a rule that would deny deductions for payments that are not subject to a minimum amount of tax, you know, in the payee or relevant jurisdiction. Part of the issue with that, I mean, there's a few issues with it. Well, one is it's a cliff edge effect. So if the minimum tax, let's say, was 15% and you paid 14% tax, you lose the entirety of the deduction. Another is it would apply if the worldwide group's gross receipts are in excess of $500 million. So the scope of U.S. companies who could be subject to SHIELD could be significantly higher than those subject to BEAT, given BEAT is $500 million of gross receipts in the United States. And it also applies to things like cost of goods sold, which BEAT does not. But one of the other really important things to note is that the way SHIELD would work, which is proposed to take effect in 2023, is that it would not apply to the extent the payee was or a relevant jurisdiction took the payment into account under their own, you know, Pillar 2 regime. So it effectively shuts SHIELD off in that fact pattern. And that ought to therefore exempt U.S. multinationals from SHIELD. But if you're a non-U.S. multinational and you've just not adopted your own Pillar 2 rule yet, then the rule would apply on the basis of what the U.S. has determined the minimum tax rate to be. Very unclear what that actually is. That the suggestion at the moment is that would be 21% on the basis of that kind of 28% corporate tax rate and a 25% GILTI deduction. It's obviously going to depend on where Congress gets to in terms of the corporate rate, also potentially the GILTI deduction, how they define it. But you could find that, you know, if, for example, we did pass the rule later this year, it did take effect in 2023, and, you know, notwithstanding the OECD's objective to get rules enacted globally by 2023, which is, I don't think, a coincidence, if that timetable starts to slip, you could start to see SHIELD kind of applying all over the place with, you know, a relatively high bar. So it's definitely something to keep an eye on. Whether we get it, not very clear whether that happens or whether they, you know, maybe modify BEAT. But there's certainly, I think, a lot of risk out there for our clients that they should at least be mindful of.
Thanks, Tom, for explaining us also the SHIELD in a very comprehensive way. And indeed, there can be an impact, even if it's currently not impacted by the BEAT. It's definitely something to look into. We're already coming to the end of the podcast. So I have, a final question for you. We have seen a very ambitious timeline by the OECD. And I wanted to ask you whether you share that ambitious timeline or that optimism around timing, or whether you see some still points that could delay the timing. Tom, perhaps starting with you.
Yeah, so from a U.S. perspective, we do think that it's still possible for the government to get something done this year. The challenges remain in terms of getting legislation passed. I think that, you know, we've discussed in previous podcasts, but it's definitely within the realm of possibility. And, you know, I would say, you know, we'd expect Congress likely to get something done. What exactly they get done is a little less clear, and when that might happen is also a little less clear. They are focused, though, on infrastructure at the moment, and that'll take them effectively through the summer. And then after that, they'll be looking to the budget and then associated tax provisions to act as pay-fors for some of these things. And I think we wouldn't expect to see some draft legislation from a tax perspective possibly until October. Pushing enactment probably, you know, later on in the year. So it might be a very similar experience to what we saw in 2017. But I do think it's, there's certainly a possibility that we'll see legislative activity later this year. It's just a little less clear what that's exactly going to include.
And maybe to add on from an EU perspective, Peter, I think we all know that the EU has made it quite clear that they want to move ahead with global minimum taxation, even without a global deal. They re-emphasized that in their proposal for business taxation of the 21st century. Now, I think the focus will be on getting those three European jurisdictions that I mentioned before over the line and to take this forward. But I do not think, if we look at the ADAT directives, etc., and the timing of those, that the timing is not realistic. I do expect that the EU will do everything to meet this ambitious goal. So the more reason to start looking into what that would mean for your company, and definitely if you're European headquartered, what that would mean for your company. Because the window to actually make changes, if there are areas where you would potentially have an impact, is also decreasing rapidly with this ambitious timeline.
Yeah, thanks, Evie and Tom. So I think what is sure is that the pace of change is definitely not gonna be reduced. We will see if the timeline ultimately will be met in 23. Or whether there is a little bit of delay, let's see that. But what is also clear is that the next weeks, other steps will be taken from a policy perspective. So we have seen this last week. I think in the next days, at some point, the G20 will underscribe this development. We will also see in Europe some developments around energy taxation and green taxation. So definitely we will come out with a new podcast if those developments happen. So I would say to the audience, stay tuned, I would say. Subscribe to the podcast so you get the latest edition. You can do that on Apple, Google, or Spotify. But with that, I want to end this podcast and thank you, Evie, Tom, for sharing your insights on these developments around global minimum taxation. And the audience, I want to thank to tune in and listen to us. And with that, I end the podcast. Thank you.